Hello everybody! Hello, hello! This is Giselle here and pleased to welcome you to the Giselle Show podcast Meet Friends, where we are making stuff up, being real and talking about it. Coming up today, we play with actor, writer and filmmaker Tom Konkul, also actor, filmmaker and clown Amos Glick. We do 100 words, which you know how much I love that. We have Metro Stop of the Day, and the podcast players present a comedy sketch, and we look into a fun game that you can play when you're stuck with your family for Thanksgiving, which is coming right up. So let me quickly do some quick introductions of our Twitters, because we're all on the Twitter and you can tweet us live. GiselleNet is at GiselleNet. Also with us today is actress Jonna Thomases, and she is at JTomato. Tom Konkul is at Tom Konkul, which is spelled TomKonkle. And Amos Glick is at Amos Glick. AmosGlick. You can participate in the show through the Twitter at the above Twitter handles or at the Giselle Show. You can email us studio@thegiselleshow.com, and you can find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, all of your favorite podcast apps. Or just go straight to our website where you can find all of this, which is podcast.thegiselleshow.com. So first let me say I'm so excited. This is our second podcast. 2 weeks ago was our first one, and I'm so excited about it. I'm still wearing my outfit from our Goodwill Swap Shop adventure. And we had so much fun doing that. I love the Goodwill. I want to say a welcome to all of our new listeners. Do you know we have listeners in Russia, the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, Germany, where I'm from, Denmark, Japan, Malta, New Zealand, and Poland. Oh, this is so great. I wanted to do this podcast, I think I told you this last week, because there's so much media entertainment coming at us all the time. And it's very easy to just get into a passive frame of mind and say, okay, entertain me. But also we can entertain ourselves. And I don't want for us to lose touch with our own creativity. So that's why I started the podcast, because we don't have to wait for permission to be creative, especially in this day of easy and less expensive technology and all the prosumer and consumer grade technology that is so good. You can just make your own artwork and share it wherever you like. That's true. So I just want to encourage everybody to do their own creativity, and to that end, share it with us here on the show so we can share it. You can find submission guidelines on the website podcast.thegiselleshow.com. It's fun to be creative. So first I want to introduce my first guest, or both of the guests, and then we will focus on one.
Sure.
Yeah. So with us today is Tom Konkul.
Hello.
And Amos Glick.
Good morning.
I want to say good morning, particularly to the Malta contingency. I've been trying to sort of build the Maltan following.
That's your demographic?
Yeah, that really is.
The Maltese?
Maltese comes up quite a bit, yeah.
Do you know it does, because of the Falcon, doesn't it?
That's true. The Maltese Falcon was a big influence on something that I'm working on. So
we
yes.
will find out about the that Maltans. In just a
yes.
moment. both ones. Tom Konkul and Amos Glick are fantastic artists and creators. And what I love about them both is that they did not wait for permission to make art. They make their own art and they just do their own thing. Tom Konkul is an actor and a filmmaker and a voiceover artist and a sketch comedian and a writer. Right now, he is the writer, head writer on Be Cool Scooby-Doo, which is a Warner Brothers animated cartoon on the Cartoon Network.
That's right. I'm the staff writer on that show. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. We're going to hear about it. And also, he has just completed his first feature film, which is called Trouble Is My Business, and it's a film noir. Which is why we were mentioning...
One of my favorite genres. Yeah, though, right full circle to the Maltese ball.
So how did you get started making your artwork?
You know what? It is about giving yourself permission. And I have always... It's for me, it's not a task or a thing that you do. It's simply who you are. I mean, you create a space for yourself and you want to express yourself. And so many people wait for permission to do it. And I've always said, you know, I don't want to be a waiter. I want to own the restaurant. So I think unfiltered creativity is so important. You were talking about technology. This is one of those rare times in history where you don't need a lot of resources and you don't need to
I know.
Move through a lot of things to reach a potential audience or certainly enough people that your art can thrive and be appreciated. So for me, it's just been an evolution as my art has continued. Technology has fortunately been kind of chasing after it, where before, if it needed to be like a 99-seat theater to try something out the way I wanted to see it, now you can reach the world by uploading it and doing whatever you can.
So technology has been chasing you, you say?
It has been chasing
following
me.
Following you?
Yeah, it's like happiness.
Hunting
it follows
you.
Me but never catches up. Yeah.
What would it do if it could? Yeah. It would be like a dog with a squirrel.
It
now
would.
That I've got
it would
you,
be
I don't
a
know
furry
what to do.
Mess if I did something. A furry mess would be a good assessment of some of my comedy.
Technology bit me in the butt.
That's
and
right.
It won't let go.
That's right. It won't let go. I'm my own USB port. That's how it is. It's sort of been following, and I've been so lucky at this point in history that stuff that I create is out there and can reach people, and you don't have to go through this huge process of getting equipment or getting permission to do it through so many layers.
Yeah.
So I the movie grew out of that. My sketch comedy found new life through technology.
I remember years ago I saw you do a sketch about a hat salesman.
Yeah, well, yes, selling different kinds of hats.
And
also,
you had
the world of hats.
The world of hats. That's just, the one that I love.
I'm trying on hats to music that don't go with the hats.
And I remember the term you used. You said at one point, ladies and gentlemen, it's hat-stacular.
It's the hat-stacular event of the season. Yeah.
I can't get that out of my head. I love that term.
To me, it was the reason that people impose meaning on performance art, like it always means something. And I remember at its inception, I was at home and I just put on a yodeling hat and there was completely incorrect music playing. So I started just laughing because I'm like, if I stood like this, looking very meaningful, someone would think this is entertaining or at least
he's doing
something.
A noble stance.
Yes, doing the noble.
Chest raised.
It's the just me pose, hands on hip, you know, looking out with a Viking hat on while polka music plays.
Like Kanye West and like that a lot.
Yeah, he does do that a lot. I wish he'd stop. It's like that. And then I remember calling Gino, who was in our group, and I go, I want to do a sketch where it's me trying on hats to music. And there's a pause, and he goes, yes, we should do
it. It
was
one
no
of my
question.
Favorite sketches. I loved it.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. I still see people sometimes that have seen it, like from old festivals that we did. There's this one guy, Gary Anthony Williams, who is...
Oh, I love Gary Anthony Williams.
I was doing
nicest
a television
guy.
Show, and all of a sudden from the bleachers I hear, World O' Hats! And it's Gary Anthony Williams. Like, I hadn't seen him in 5 years, and I'm like, okay, that's random. But he's like, dude, I remember that. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff you love, because it's like, that was something I wanted to do. It made me laugh, and that was the point.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah. You do things to make yourself laugh.
Yes, it's too much work to do something to make only someone else laugh.
To make only someone else. It's good to make them laugh too.
Yes.
Definitely.
If someone agrees with you, you can stay in the business.
Yeah.
You know, if they don't agree with you, you have to leave. Yeah. If it's only you laughing, it's kind of sad.
It eventually.
You know how that is. I know how that is. Sometimes if it's just me laughing, it's a little sad.
But apparently you make enough people laugh, because now let me ask you about your day job, which is you're the staff writer for this cartoon, the Scooby-Doo, Be Cool Scooby-Doo.
That's right. I work with John Colton Berry. He was kind enough to bring me in. We came from a sketch background. He did a sketch show called Playthings, and he worked very closely creating the Phineas and Ferb show. And so we've been fans of each other forever. So he had me do an episode for the first season called Area 51 Adjacent.
Which I love that.
Two more secret than, you know, than Area 48. Yeah. So we did this, and I had this crazy idea for it.
Yeah, if it's
and
adjacent, like, isn't it Area 50 or 52?
Hey, but it's 51's the really hot one. So if you're going to list it, you put 51 gotcha, okay. adjacent. Yeah, that way you get much better.
Yeah, know, much better.
Much better UFOs.
Realtor advised you on
that's right.
This.
Yeah, you get better Yeti, better UFOs, everything in Area 51 adjacent. And it's cheaper, you know.
And we have a clip.
You do? Okay, great.
We have a clip. Do you want to introduce what this clip is?
Well, basically the gang, the Scooby gang, ends up in the desert, and there has been a mysterious sighting of something.
And this clip is the mysterious sighting, what happens to this group of kids. Okay, here we go.
This is Evergreen Cemetery. Catherine is the key.
Okay, let's get a group picture.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about you, dude?
I'm gonna be in it. Brayden, Matt, move to the left. No, the other left. Your right, my left. Okay. Ruby, move closer to Brayden. No, the other Brayden. No, the other Brayden. Good. Now Tyler, move farther from further. Further, get nearer to the other Brayden, and farther from the other Brayden.
Hurry up and take the picture, man.
What is that? Whoa, I think that plane is crashing.
Did anyone get that?
Come on, maybe someone needs help. Hey, are you okay?
Speaking of technology, when he says the line, did anyone get that? Literally, all the kids are texting on their phone going, hey, there's something crashing right here. And then all the characters look up and like they completely missed it because they can't even experience it in the first person. So I wrote it as a parody. And you know, because I have a son, and actually the character that's based on my friend Brittany's son named Tyson, like they experience everything secondhand through their personal devices. So I thought, wouldn't it be funny to like literally have the meteor go over and you see all these 14 kids all going, you won't believe this. Did you see it? No. What happened? You know, did you get a picture? You know.
So it's like you get to do social commentary.
Yes.
Little there, bit.
Comedy tells the truth. It opens the door. It's actually the shortest distance to
telling
the truth.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And so even in a kid's show like this, I can feather in little things.
Can
and
I ask?
John,
yeah, please.
So are you encouraged by your superiors to delve into that? Or is it more that you have to slip it in when it feels right and you know you can do it without ruffling any feathers?
You know what? John Colton Berry has my back, and Zach, the producer, really has my back. A lot of the guys have my back. Obviously, getting the plot across is of A, importance, but funny trumps everything. And so for this show to differentiate it from the other kinds of Scooby shows, we wanted it to be the kind of smart that, you know, Python is smart, or you know.
Well, I love growing up. I mean, watching my favorite cartoons were always the ones that I still love now as an adult.
Yeah,
so I get it.
It's hopefully an adult enjoys it on a different level than a child. I think the best cartoons, the best kids entertainment, is like that. And it's funny that I would end up in this realm, but it actually kind of makes sense that having a sketch background, if you can string those sketches together and hang them on a strong narrative, like Scooby-Doo, which has a very structured narrative. There's certain expectations you have to hit. But with the best comedy, you know, stuff that I grew up with, you know, Young Frankenstein or Holy Grail, everything, they're sketches that are basically connected together. So for a sketch comedian, that's why John Colton Berry and I got along. It's like, let's make the funniest sketches where sometimes the punchline's the scare, but you can also satirize the actual medium. We do a thing at the end of the episode you have to see where we deconstruct meddling kids. And it's fantastic.
Oh, I'd love to
and
see
the other dream come true was I wrote, you know, I do some of the voices sometimes, and I wrote a general character in that I really wanted to play. But then I found out Mark Hamill wanted to do an episode of it, and he picked that character.
Hold on, Mark Hamill?
Yeah, and I'm like the 14-year-old me is going, yes, Luke Skywalker wants to do it. But what was super cool about it is I had lavished so much attention on that character because I knew it was going to be something I would play. And so, of course, he, at being an actor, you know what it's like. You went, that's a real juicy
that's the
part.
Juicy one,
and of
yeah.
course, he's like, hey, I'm an actor. Of course I picked the one you wrote for yourself. You know. And but then seeing his name up there and doing it, it was a great validation.
Did you get to do any of the voices on there?
I ended up, he did the voice on that.
He did.
But I'm going to be doing some voices and some upcoming ones that are going. So,
I have one more question about
writing.
Yeah.
So along the same lines of writing satire or political commentary, have you ever written anything that you've been told, we can't do that?
Every day.
I would just love to hear an example of what comes up at a children's show that's not...
Yeah, I mean, anything that has an innuendo, anything that's too sharp or pointed, you know, as far as criticism.
Can you give an example of maybe one of the more political points?
Did you have a storyline about opiate addiction?
No, that one went straight through, really. I had no notes. Yeah. It may be something. It smelled funny in the room, so I don't know. Maybe they were on opiates. Well, yeah, I mean, there are, without getting too specific, there are ones where you might lob a joke in that is either too meta about the show, like deconstructs the show, or something that an adult would appreciate. Like I had a thing about plumbing, and it was an innocent sounding joke, but when you deliver it very sincerely, like, you know, ever since the maintenance man went insane, I haven't been able to unclog my plumbing. And then the guy just painfully walked out of frame, but it's because he fell out a window. But the fact that he's walking like this, talking about his plumbing, everyone was like, what are you doing? And I'm like, you guys have dirty minds. He fell out of the window. What are you thinking? You know, and so there's stuff like that comes up that you cut out and you don't self-censor when you're writing. But yeah, there's certain constraints that when you're doing it, you know, you put that, I call it the dump file. And in the dump file are all the things that any good sketch comedian or anybody who just lives comedy, you're constantly making notes. Like if someone...
Oh, yeah. Because then you can use it later on.
That's right. If Jonna Tomasis called me and said she wanted to do a sketch show, I have a little folder full of sketches for the last 10 years that I would seriously go,
what do you say?
Let's do these.
What do you say, Jonna? Would you call her? I might call you.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. It's Jonna here.
Hey, there she is, and I would do comedy with you because I live it. And if an idea doesn't fit, like you were saying, if it fits into the parameter, well, then you don't throw out a good idea.
That's
You're like,
right.
Okay, I'm going to do this. You know, there's a sketch that I've been wanting to do forever called Dr. Mallet, and it's basically you go to Dr. Mallet, and he has a different mallet to cure whatever ailment you have. So it's like, well, I have a slight rash. Ah, that would be the number 3. And so he goes and gets like a mallet, you know, and it ends with like a vasectomy joke where he's like, that's the 11, you know. And it's like, what do you do with Dr. Mallet? Well, I call you and I go, you want to do Dr. Mallet?
I'm in.
All of a sudden, it fits into that format so mm-hmm. perfectly because you don't have to tell a whole story or an arc. It's just silly until you're done being silly and then you don't need an out. Mm-hmm. So there's some ideas that they fit the medium, whatever it is. And
now,
I think that's important, is figuring out your creativity to fit whatever medium you're putting it in, whether it's musical or whether it's comedy. There are places like with audio humor, you can say, ah, there's the elephant. And then everyone watching goes, oh, yes, I see it in my head. But if you're doing an animated show, you've got to draw it. Or if you're creating
You're
it
giving
live.
Away the big finish of the show, which
I'm sorry,
is
put the
elephant.
Away for you. That's not even real. It's a pachyderm, really. Yeah.
Quiet down, sorry. Bessie. We're not ready for you yet. Stay in,
that was
stay
me,
in
actually.
The green room.
Yeah. Beans are off.
Yeah. Now, I want also to talk about this beautiful film that you made.
You. Yes.
That you made a film noir.
A feature film, yeah.
Feature film noir called Trouble Is My Business.
Trouble Is My Business is a departure for me, but it isn't. There are many aspects, as you know, of any person who's creative. I love the genre of film noir because it's pure cinema. It tells a story by really expressionist shots. It's about human conditions. It has a very dark sense of humor, but it's drama. And
you
it's
was telling
great.
Me that you narrowed it down to, you distilled it, you watch a lot of film noir and you
yes.
distilled what film noir is about.
Yes.
Two things.
It is. It's really about two things. It's about and it's exploring the darkness of human nature, and for me, it's also the visual language of film, and what I tried to do is go, well, what was it about the original film noirs that resonate with people now? And what was it about the books of the time that they were based on? If I took a Chandler book, like a Raymond Chandler book, off the shelf now, and I enjoyed it for what it was, without the Hays Commission, without some of the censorship things, why were these pulp stories and these noir stories resonating with people even now? Like, why do we do L.A. Confidential? Why do people still resonate with it? And so with Trouble, I took everything in it, and I just kind of processed it in my head, and I said, well, what would I want to see, or what would I have to say about it? And it ended up not being sort of a winking modern look at it, but I wanted to make a film, and I was like, well, if John Huston had a red camera, digital camera, and he could shoot in color, and he had these resources, and he had this to do, what would you do? What story would you tell?
So what is the movie about?
The movie is about he's a disgraced missing persons detective, and he falls in love.
Played by you.
Played by me. And his name is Roland Drake, and he's just about to get evicted. His world is completely crumbled because a Caligula-like police chief has ruined him. He actually was not able to find this missing girl. She died, and he took the fall for it. And he has a black book of information that basically kept him out of jail. And then Redemption walks in with Curves.
Redemption
That's
with
right.
Curves.
And it's a blonde and brunette. They're twins, and they're twin sisters. And one wants to kill him, and the other one is dead. And he falls in love with both of them. And we meet them through the process of flashing forward in time, backward in time.
And what is he trying to solve or do?
He is trying to redeem himself. And he needs to find out who murdered the first sister that he loves. And also, how do you escape? How information is more important than things. So this family had money. But you can't walk in with a diamond and buy a sandwich. You can't do anything.
Don't give it away.
But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but
And the essential part of the film is the currency of information, even in noir, is more important. What you can blackmail someone with, what you know something about.
This is all really heady stuff.
Very important. Yeah, and so ultimately the film is about him finding out that you see a brick wall coming. We all have a friend who don't. You know, don't get involved with her. Don't do this thing. You see the wall coming up, and they still hit that wall. And what's fascinating about it is it's not a whodunit; it's a whydunit.
Oh. So this is not a comedy. This is a true noir.
It's a true noir. It has elements of comedy because I'm in it. David Beeler, who I did comedy with for 13 years, I think comedic actors make the best actors for drama. And the reason is that there isn't that need to feel serious and taken serious. It's funny because life is funny, and you're in noir, it's a love of language and words, so you're cleverer in the movie than you would
be
in life.
We have a clip.
Please.
We have a clip. Do you want to set this up?
This is Lou McDonald, played by David Beeler, and he is in a car with Roland Drake, and they are driving to a cemetery. At the opening of the film, he goes, take me to the cemetery, she's still alive.
Okay, here we go.
This is Evergreen Cemetery.
Catherine is the key.
And trust me, I've learned enough about this family to know that someone's gonna be at the DA's grave tonight.
I have more than one gun, you know.
I was counting on it, Lou.
I'll take priceless, over half a priceless any day. Give me the black book, Roland.
You don't want the diamond?
No. What would I do with it? I couldn't even buy a sandwich with that diamond. But the black book, now, that's everything in the city.
I guess you can trade cash for ruining lives forever, huh? Where I'm going, I don't need it. And I'm not coming back.
Where is it? Don't think I won't use this.
And here I thought we made a... Go to the Dropbox. One we used when we were in business together.
I'm not fond of you, Roland. I think you should go away. But with her. Someplace bright. Where you can see things coming. You always were a little too shiny for the city.
In this world, the one that cares more always loses.
The one with a gun always wins. Get out.
I'm really proud of that scene.
That is a great scene.
It's a great out. He's
and
holding
I love
the gun
the
on
ride.
Him at the end, and he's like, the one with the gun usually wins.
The one with the gun always wins.
There's a wonderful wink in that performance that's great. You know, he is the antithesis of Roland. He is about appearance. He's about doing everything right, but looking the part and being willing to compromise his morals to do whatever. And that's why he and Roland actually split. He's the darker half of Roland.
Wow,
And ultimately, he's hired to follow him.
Very exciting.
It's a great
It's a beautiful scene, and also the cinematography is beautiful. Now, where are you at with the business of the movie?
Okay, with the business of the movie,
You finished it, and you're going to distribute?
Yes, it's going to come out next year, early 2016.
Wow.
We are hoping to get a what would be like a video on demand and hopefully some television sales. I would love to have a very limited theatrical. We shot it in 4K. 4K is the very large format, like IMAX format. So it's ready for, you know, any future technologies. It's shot. It's basically one of the first films shot in 4K on an indie level like this because we used very new technology. We actually, there's this thing called a Shogun recorder, and we were some of the first people to ever use it for a feature film.
Mm, wow.
And I'm really grateful for that. And being able to use the technology, we do all of the effects in-house. So all of the post, except for some of the sound, which you were hearing a raw cut sound, we haven't actually done the final mix, is done by us, by my company Luminactus. So we are doing all the compositing. There's 2,000 composite effects. It has all vintage cars, all vintage costumes.
Wow. It's cool. Oh, that's so great.
Yeah,
and I saw that you're going to be releasing it both in black and white
and
in color.
Yeah, a dual release.
Now, the clips that I watch, I wanted to watch it in black and white.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it was beautiful.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you can go onto the internet. The website is troubleismy.biz. That's very clever because the movie is called Trouble Is My Business.
Yeah,
so they got troubleismy.biz, and there's clips you can watch. There's also more clips on the YouTube.
Yes.
Trouble Is My Business.
We have trailers and
trailers and all that.
There's
going
to be a great behind the scenes too, and you get to see. We have some really fun stars. There's a guy from Australia named Vernon Wells who's been in a ton of stuff.
I know him.
Yeah, he's great. He plays the villain.
What a great face he has.
Beautiful.
He has
Mount Rushmore.
You know, that's when you move. You don't have a face, you have a mug.
Yes, he has a mug.
He has
a
mug, right? That's the word you use, the mug.
I there's a scene where he's sort of interrogating me, and I had to really, it was a trust scene. I was tied for real to a chair, and he has to punch me in the face and take all these different things, and he's a big guy. And of course, the, 11-year-old me is going, oh my God, the guy from Road Warrior's beating me, and there was so much just trust that it became this just one-on-one, and we upped each other's game.
Did you kiss?
Huh?
Did you kiss?
He kissed me with his fist. He actually missed one time.
He kissed
He kissed me with my fist. Could be another film noir title.
Yes.
He kissed me with my fist.
With his fist.
That's right.
Kissed me with your
fist. The cat came on little tiny death feet. Yeah.
Kissed
me with your fist. Yeah. No,
Tom, that is such exciting stuff.
Thank you.
Really
and
exciting
is this,
stuff.
Is this project completely self-produced, or did you have any backing going
we
into
had
it?
Some crowdfunding. It was mostly personal finance credit. I'm mortgaged up to my ears.
Woo-hoo.
Yay, woo! A lot of it was generosity of people. There's a place called the Automotive Driving Museum, which is in La Jolla here, and they have all these vintage cars that they gave me for free that they let me drive around. The man that runs it stayed there till 4 a.m. sometimes because he believed in the movie. He saw that it was a very literate movie and we respected the period of the 40s. Mm-hmm. So he's like, what kind of car do you want? You want a Plymouth? Yeah, okay, I'll get it. And he got me a 1947 Plymouth. Where all the scene with Dave is in a real vintage car that we're driving.
So
and
great.
I encourage you to go down there and support this. They go by donations, and they the docent there will allow people to drive in a vintage car with them. So they have weekend events for families and kids.
In La Jolla?
Yeah, and it's called the Automobile Driving Museum.
The Automobile Driving Museum in La Jolla, California, United States.
Correct.
I'll do it.
Yes.
Maybe we do a segment from there for the podcast. That would be really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. You stick around. We're going to do a lot more fun stuff.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce our other guest, Mr. Amos Glick.
Hi, Giselle.
Hello, Amos. Amos Gleick is an actor and a writer and a comedian and a clown and a filmmaker and a nice guy.
Yeah, that's about it. my life is in bullet points. There's no need to elaborate.
You have a great bio. I asked you to email it to me and you did.
Yes, read the first line because that's how I feel.
Amos Gleick is a hack of all trades, possessing just enough skill and enthusiasm to be able to get paid for acting, singing, clowning, teaching, and playing guitar and mandolin. He was for years in the Bay Area, where he was with San Francisco Mime Troupe, SF Mime Troupe. He was with the New Pickle Circus and Bats Improv and True Fiction Magazine. And he do movies. Since 2007, he has been a clown in Las Vegas with the show La Rev. Le Rev.
Le Rev.
Le Rev.
Now, it used to be called Le Rev, but they changed it to Le Rev, the dream.
Le Rev, the dream.
Correct.
Because nobody knew what Le Rev meant.
Well, I don't know that it matters because there's other shows. Most Cirque du Soleil type shows, although mine is not Cirque, they have crazy names like
Bing Bang Hong Kong
and Alegria and
Saltimbanco.
Saltimbanco.
Yeah, but it's like Japanese cars where they make up words, you know. It's like, Dijalan Trabonda. It's like, that's not a real word. Is there a colon in there? Le Rev colon?
I don't remember. No, I think it's just
the
two
dash?
Separate lines.
Yeah.
Oh, two lines.
Two lines.
It's very important that we nail down the graphics on this.
That's right.
How it's laid out.
That's right. Yeah.
So you have been the many, many years now in Las Vegas being a clown in this
Never
show.
Never thought it would happen. I had no orientation towards ending up in Vegas. In fact, probably desiring to stay as far away from as possible, as far as a place to live and work. And it, for some reason, my path took me there, and it's been great.
But yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of former circus performers in Las Vegas because there's such a glut of opportunity to do performing of that kind and do that kind of artwork.
Or, I mean, a lot of older circus performers end up there as riggers or other. They do other stuff in the industry. A lot of wardrobe people, technicians of all types are former acrobats, like a very high stature. Like the half of the team that did one of the biggest trapeze tricks in history. I don't remember what it's called. I think it was a quadruple. The Flying Vasquez brothers, one of them I work with, he's a rigger. Great guy. And it's like half of his family is there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they're great people. I mean, that's the other cool thing is that they're not just, you know, sometimes technicians are a bit wonky, you know, depending on where you come from. But, you know, being in an industry where a lot of the technicians, seriously, a lot of them used to be performers, just
they
breathes
understand.
A different type of life. And they all speak different languages. Yeah. There's Russians and Spanish and Italian. And
I have a question. Yes, Jonah. I think you know almost that I used to be a circus clown as well.
Ringling.
With Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. And it's an interesting thing having something so playful be your day job.
Yeah.
So how is that for you since your day job is clowning?
It's a two-edged sword. I mean, you really, you know, I've done, I don't know how many shows I've done, probably over 3,500 shows. The same thing, 10 shows a week, 9 years. So
you make it sound so fun.
Well, no, it's
how
intense.
How do you keep it fresh every time?
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing is that along the way, well, of course, along the way, I'm taking workshops, I'm teaching, I'm doing projects. So I've got stuff going on outside. And in fact, this opportunity really gave me the financial ability and also for some reason.
You mean your day job gave you the financial ability.
And for some reason, I don't know if it's age or the fact that I was in that environment, just the emotional and mental space to be able to do stuff outside that has furthered my career. But staying in a show like that, I mean, you must find a way to keep it fresh. I mean, and
so what do you do?
Well, I mean, I employ, I there's tricks. I mean, there's
potpourri, spritzing. No. How do you freshen it up in there?
No, yeah. I mean, I've studied.
You need Febreze for the soul.
Yeah, right.
Febreze I've studied a, of, I've, well, it's funny. I've studied some, you know, different types of physical theater. One with this group in Brazil called Lume, and I don't even know what they would call their style. I call it the theater of exhaustion. I mean, they basically it seems like you run around for hours until you are a good actor. It's not that simple. It's a lot more complicated.
But I love that plan.
That's what it feels
Keep running. You're not that good yet.
I'm serious.
In LA, they call that auditioning. You run around until you get
to I
was in the workshop, and I remember I'm following instructions. You know, you're walking through cotton candy. You're walking through molasses. You're doing all this stuff. You're moving. All of a sudden, these other people are being called over by the teacher. They're being talked to. It seemed like they were doing something right. The rest of us are just running around going, what the fuck, man? What about us? We're still running.
Maybe.
It's fascinating.
But wait, let me finish the thought, if I might.
Okay, yeah.
So I also studied some viewpoint stuff. And one of the things, which Jana, you and I have talked about, Jana, kinesthetic response.
Yes.
So that can really help if you're in
Explain.
If you're in a humdrum, if you're in a doing the same thing every day, kinesthetic response is just the complete awareness of your surroundings and that your movement is based on any impulse that happens.
Okay, one of you explained that to me. Jana Amos, tell me more. What is this kinesthetic movement?
So as the performer or the actor, if you're in a neutral state, in a space, anything that happens in the space is a justification and inspires movement.
Well, like if you see someone move or if your scene partner gives you a look.
Something
or
drops off the wall, which has happened in workshops, which is
you're
great.
You're just right. reacting to
I
what you...
I call it
you,
being yes. present. You know, when I was acting in trouble, it was like if someone gave me something unexpected, you don't break out and go, no. You go, okay,
thing about this training is that it translates into movement.
So you mean you move in response to what you see in the moment, what you experience in the moment?
It's not an internal thing.
Oh, it's not just about feeling.
At least
feeling.
The way that I did it in workshops.
Right.
So that if I'm sitting here looking at you and all of a sudden a book drops and I'm talking to you, if the book drops over there, I'm not going to continue talking to you. I'm going to immediately
turn your head.
Maybe I would keep looking, you know, my body would respond to it.
You would react.
Manner.
You would have a physical reaction.
So the relation to that, to doing the same thing every day, is that you're on stage and you're watching a guy do his act. And like I have a scene where I basically sit on a bench and I watch three separate acts happen and I do nothing else. I'm just parsley on the plate.
That term, parsley on the plate.
And,
how long did you have to run around to learn to be parsley?
that is kind of I studied with this one guy.
Go via celery. Said, yeah.
I studied with.
Keep going. You're cilantro. Keep going.
Cilantro. You're almost there.
You're almost there.
No, not broccoli.
Yeah.
Not broccoli.
Go back.
Parsley.
Dial down the Brussels sprouts. Yeah.
I did take one workshop where the guy was like, before we put on the comedia masks, you must learn to be a rock. Not a fun workshop.
You pay $400 to study with him and he have you lying on the floor in a little ball.
You are a rock.
We want you to act like Dwayne Johnson. Yeah.
That would be more
That's
fun.
That's the rock, yeah.
Yeah. But I still haven't finished my thought.
Okay.
Which is that, you know, I'm on stage, I'm focusing on, or I'm trying to focus on this performer doing their thing because that's my job, but I'm not, my mental space is somewhere else. I am elsewhere. And because I've done it 5 million times, but then something happens on stage, which is part of the choreography and the lighting and the sound cues, and I'm able to jerk my body, even if I'm not mentally following the story in that one moment, I've trained my body now to hopefully be on cue with following the changes in the show physically. Sometimes I get into trouble because it's doing the body the same, doing this thing the same time, the same way every day. My body will automatically go like that before the sound has come. And so
jump.
There's supposed to be a lightning bolt or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, and sometimes you jump before the lightning.
That's premature articulation.
There you go.
I think. That is premature articulation.
But there's a gazillion little things like that that you learn to do. And then you learn stuff along the way, you know. The easiest is just being acutely aware of people on stage. And even if I don't feel like I'm in my character per se in that moment, as long as I'm really engaged with the people, I'm noticing what they're doing, there's going to be a live, real interaction between us on stage so that I don't just look like a pedestrian on the stage walking around.
Yeah, can I ask a question?
Please, to do.
As a sketch guy myself, and there's also the dialogue between you and the audience. I
wish there was. There's not anymore.
See, I feel like, though, to do good sketch, you have to read the room. Just like you're pitching a story to, say, an executive, that skill came from me doing sketch. You can walk into a room and you can kind of tell which way the audience is going. Do you have any of that? Or you said you wish you had that?
Clowning is all about the audience. Right. I mean, really. Especially if you're a solo artist. And our original material, we were in the audience for quite a bit of time, and we responded to the audience. We had callback jokes that went back to stuff that happened in the audience, and that was all cut out for one reason or another. And at one point, we were even given the direction that this, even though it's a theater in the round, this is a fourth wall experience. There is a fourth wall, which
you can't put
a fourth wall into a theater in the round, I don't think.
It's tough.
But that's what was imposed upon us. And so we still do have, there's one act where if the audience is very responsive in certain ways, we definitely do and should.
Right.
And it doesn't seem that the higher-up's mind that we respond and let that moment breathe. But
can you still, as a performer, though, just from the sketch days, you can walk out and you can kind of tell the mood and the tone
of
the audience, because there's something about the radar where you're like, I'm going to need to do this, or I'm going to need to, I will modify on the fly based on if it's a hostel.
Oh yeah. There's acts where we just know it's going to go quicker, because if we try to juice it,
it's not going
to
work.
It's not even really juicing, but if we try to do all the fun stuff that does work, it just won't work.
Yep.
So we just got to get through it.
I did a television show, a sketch show with John Cleese one time, and we were talking about comedy because it was just he and I doing these sketches, and he goes, one night we went out and nothing worked. And he goes, for that moment, it wasn't funny. We just went through it as fast as we could, and then the next day everyone roared, and he goes, it's funny again.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's an interesting way of looking at it, is because it is the give and take between you and the audience, and if it doesn't land, you just get through it and keep going, because it's just a different vibe. It's not as funny unless everyone experiences it.
There's something
else. This is one thing I like, what I'm hearing is the more you make art, the more you get comfortable not having so much riding on it. So if you don't get the reaction that you want this one time, you're not devastated. Oh my goodness, I can't go on, I'm ruined, or nobody like me. You just take it on your strides, and then you keep making more art.
Right. And that's the difference with technology now. I've found the hardest thing for me is the delay. A written LOL in a comment is a considered reaction, instead of performing live and getting that immediate laugh. Even if someone in the moment goes, that was funny, I'm going to write a comment, it's still one step removed through all media now.
You still have to do you still do work on the stage? That's why I love to do my storytelling.
I love it's to really do fun. Stage work, but the problem is
that... You don't have time.
Well, I don't have time, but also an interesting thing happens. Most people say they can't make it. Can I send it to them on tape or a video?
Oh, yes.
Doing it live.
Yeah.
And there's that wall. And Dave Beeler and I, when we did a British comedy team, a fake British comedy team, and... one day we uploaded one of our sketches, and more people in that one day saw one of our works than had seen us in the last 10 years of touring.
Amazing.
And that was the moment we never did it again.
Because
it took the same amount of effort to do the live show as it did this one production, and we had 1.5 million views.
Yeah.
And you could play theaters for years and never get a
million views. Yeah, that's
true. So that was interesting.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the Giselle Show podcast, Mit Friends. We are tweeting at The Giselle Show. You can email us studio@thegiselleshow.com. We're on all your favorite podcast apps, and our website is podcast.thegiselleshow.com. We will be coming back with 100 words of creative writing, a metro stop of the day, and a story from Giselle. But right now, please to enjoy this amazing song from Mr. Amos Glick.
Yo, 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 check it, check it, Bavakasha. Some people say the Jews, we ain't got soul, but we've been throwing down since Moses, yo. Keeping thousands of years of the Sabbath tradition, shit like the pogroms and the Inquisition.
Once a week, we take a bit of rest from this crazy-ass world that keeps us all out of breath. Let the wine flow. Free your head, say a little prayer over braided bread.
On Shabbat we choose be chillin', wrapping art to fillin', while all the goys be illin'.
Oh, snap.
Don't be a Shabbos villain.
Shabbat shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. In your home, I'm gonna holla at ya. Shabbat shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. Alecha mina aretz gonna holla at ya.
We say the Kiddush. It's a sanctification over the wine we drink on this weekly vacation. Sing a few songs, eat fresh challah, then we cap it all off by reciting the Havdalah.
Baruch Ata Adonai.
What's up, Hashem?
Eloheinu Melech Haolam.
King of the world.
Borei Morei Ha'eid.
And Fuego.
Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna challah at ya. In your home, I'm gonna challah at ya. Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna challah at ya. Alecha Mina Aretz gonna challah at ya. Tradition.
Shabbat, the Sabbath, the day of rest, is also the word for Saturday. Sabbatical, referring to letting farmland lay fallow every 7 years, also comes from the word Shabbat. The day of rest is Saturday, Shabbat. The day of rest is Saturday, Shabbat. Saturday, not Sunday, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, in your home. You gotta put a yarmulke at the top of your dome. Diaspora Rome, you know I'm the home. Most of us are lactose intolerance prone. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. In your home, I'm gonna holla at ya. Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. Alecha Mina Aretz gonna holla at ya. Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. In your home, I'm gonna holla at ya. Shabbat Shalom, I'm gonna holla at ya. Alecha Mina.